Welcome to my blog talk radio show, Live Your Music. I'm Margot Joy Denader, and I am a creative life balance coach, singer, songwriter, and author of The Art of Living a Life You Love. I am happy and excited to have my inspiring, creative, talented, and fun friend, Ben Parker, as my guest today. Ben is an artist, Toastmaster, speaker, and is the author of a book called A Field Guide to the F Word. Today we'll be talking about Ben's 100th birthday, his art, his book, travel, Toastmasters, and what he wants to share with us about life here on Earth. Welcome, Ben. Oh my gosh, I am so excited to have you on the show again, and it's been so much fun knowing you since you joined Toastmasters in 2013. What am I saying? I'm going back to the 1990s. Oh my gosh. It's just been awesome having you in our Toastmasters club. And I'd like to start out with talking a little bit about why did you join Toastmasters again, rejoin it at 92 years of age?
I had been a member for several years back, and I realized that I don't know why it crossed my mind one day, something came up about Toastmasters, and I realized I'd been kind of missing it, so I checked around and found there was one right here in Mill Valley that would be convenient, and, you know, the rest is history, so to speak. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
Oh, I remember so well when you joined, and I remember being inspired just by the fact that you were joining Toastmasters, well, rejoining Toastmasters at 92 years of age. And I had been in the club for a few years at that point, and I just was so impressed with the fact that you had decided to join it at 92. And one of the things I've noticed with our club, it's Wednesday nights, and it's a couple hours long. And so we get a lot of creative people in our club, and you are one of them. I can't believe all the things that you do with your creativity, and you amaze me. So today I'd like to talk a little bit also about curiosity. And I think that curiosity is one of the things that keeps life interesting. I know it does for me, and I talked to you before about that curiosity is important. So what do you have to tell us about curiosity and keeping your mind open?
Well, you have mentioned before your interest in curiosity and your realizing the importance of it. And, you know, I find it difficult, really, to even discuss that subject. I don't see how anybody can be anything but curious. I really don't. I don't understand the lack of curiosity. I really don't. I mean, I do know people. I guess I don't know anybody well who is completely uncurious, no. I don't see how anybody can fail to be curious, so I'm no help on that subject.
Well, I think that personally that's one of the things that keeps life interesting and fun, and it's one of my theories about why you are still here at 100 years and why you're still having fun is because you are curious about people, about life, about the world, and
because of everything,
you know. And I have to say that, you know, there was a time probably before you joined Toastmasters where I remember talking about curiosity at the club, and it was amazing when I asked how many people were curious. A lot of people didn't raise their hands, even in our club at the time. And what I think keeps us young is being curious about life. You know, that's part of what kids are like. They're curious about everything. Why does this happen? Why do you do it this way? What if we do it that way? Where can, you know, I don't know, just constantly being curious. And I think that's part of
it. And you're right, it does start. Very small children are automatically curious. They start being fascinated by their toes.
Exactly. Exactly.
That is true. And then your horizons expand.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so true. But I do see, you know, I think that part of the problems that we have in the world today about people going, well, I'm right and you're wrong and that sort of thing is because they're not curious about each other and about ways that we can connect with each other and collaborate with each other and communicate with each other. And so, you know, that's one of the things that
yep.
Toastmasters does is helps us learn to connect, communicate, and to get to know each other.
You know, this matter of being able to look at things from the outside, no more. There's a technique, maybe you've heard of this, I don't know what it's called. It's a technique used often in labor negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And that is you appoint a spokesman for each side, and you can do this even one-on-one discussion with somebody,
mm-hmm.
And ask them to present the position of the other side.
Oh, interesting.
It's amazing how often when this happens, somebody's trying to explain, for instance, in labor negotiations, they get halfway through the explanation, the other side says, but that isn't my position. Well, all of a sudden, it turns out they've been talking past each other. They weren't talking about the same thing, and they were heated arguments about something that wasn't up for grabs. It's very interesting to have to state the position of the other side if you can understand it. I'm not expressing this well, but you know what
no,
I mean.
No, I totally get what you're saying, and I think that's a lot of Toastmasters teaches us to get over our fear of speaking, and to, as Kathleen, our current president, always says, the fun of speaking, you know. But the thing is that it also teaches us to listen. And not just hear,
yes, it does.
But to actually listen to people and understand what they're saying and to be understood. So both ways.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that's been so valuable for with Toastmasters for me is a combination of learning to be understood, but mostly learning how to listen and to learn from the other people and be curious about them. And, you know, it's just been so wonderful. And the thing is that even with the pandemic, our Toastmasters Club went on Zoom right away and in March of last year. So we've been doing the meetings on Zoom weekly now. And you've been still a part of that during the whole time. So, I mean, you have seen so many changes in your life, and I just can't even believe how many things that you've been through and seen. And just, you know, I want to hear whatever you want to tell us about what it's like to live here on Earth, and what are some of your favorite memories of travel and being on Oahu and some of those things, too. So,
well, one thing, this matter of changes, 100 years is just kind of automatically calls for review, looking back, taking a look at the whole thing. What was it all about? You know, the works. And mm-hmm. It is true that over this much of a span of time, I have seen changes, major changes. Things like, well, for example, I was born in 1921, and the Depression started in 1929.
Mm-hmm.
So from the age of 8 until the age of 18, when we started coming out of the Depression in 1939, my formative years, 8 to 18, were Depression times, and it was simply a different world. And it's very difficult from here to have any comprehension of what the Depression was like.
Mm-hmm.
You see statistics, but that doesn't cover the human elements, which is we were all in it together, and I, you know, really pretty mad. And then there was World War II, and an illustration of how we get along together when we have to. World War II, you know, we kind of start with Pearl Harbor and end with VE Day, and meanwhile there were things that there were movies about and that sort of stuff, but that it doesn't really capture the way we really were all pulling together. All kinds of stuff was rationed, far more than automobiles and tires, everything else at various times. And people really did take their aluminum pots and pans down to be melted down and made into bombers. You don't see anything like that kind of national purpose today. I guess we are tribal animals, and when there's something serious going on, we link arms and go to work on it. We really do.
Yeah.
Maybe there's hope for us yet, huh?
I hope so. I really hope so. But yeah, I think that communication is such an important part of all of it, and I think that that's one of the reasons why I wanted to start out with talking about Toastmasters, because it's been such an incredible education for me about communication and for all of us about communication. And I just think that if everybody went to Toastmasters, they would learn to communicate, they would learn to listen, they would learn to be more curious, they'd learn to be able to understand each other. So,
do you get paid a bounty for bringing people into Toastmasters?
What was that?
Do you get paid a bounty for bringing people into Toastmasters? You certainly sell it.
No, I just have had such a great experience with it, because I was so afraid to even join. And then in 2004, just before I turned 51, I decided I would go to one Toastmasters meeting. And it was just, you know, right away I got hooked on it. You know, the people that were there were just so kind and so friendly and so encouraging and so positive. And that's so much of what you have been for people during while you've been in Toastmasters, is that you have been so encouraging and so inspiring. And you are a great storyteller, a humorous speaker, and you know, you've done one contest for us at the club, and I love your humorous speech about George. Do you want to talk about George a little bit, or do you want to talk about something else?
Oh, we probably talked enough. Hard to touch on George without going into detail. Suffice it to say that it was a made-up story given about a guy who was the house guest from hell. And the thing that was interesting about George is he's a complete knucklehead, and he misunderstands anything anybody says. Well, he's hard to describe.
Yeah, well, you do.
A lady said at one point, I can't stand another minute after some fresh horror he's inflicted on his hosts. So he sat her down in a chair and explained that standing too long was not good for the circulation. That was our George.
Yeah.
Anyhow, let's move on from George.
Okay, let's move on from George. So let's talk a little bit about your travel and your keys that you have behind you. Travel.
I am so glad I did the travel I did, the international travel I did do back in the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s. Travel in, say, the 60s was so different from what it is today. For one thing, there were not many people were engaged in international travel back then, nothing like it is now. As a result, the planes weren't crowded, the airports weren't crowded, the food was even passable. And I guess the biggest single thing is when you got there, it was more different from home. now the world is just getting homogenized, and the local color isn't there like it used to be. So as I say, I'm glad I got that done. Think, for instance, I made a trip around the world, and at that point, this was one of the countries I went through was Afghanistan. And the Russians hadn't come to Afghanistan then. Afghanistan was still the frontier. The British really never conquered it. It was frontier country. Remember movies like The Lives of Bengal Lancer and stuff? It was frontier. But now there are army trucks going over the Khyber Pass, and I did it in a local bus. So many, many things about travel back then were simply more fun than they are. Oh, it was on that trip. You mentioned the keys. So on that trip, I was in Iran and passed a junk shop where there were some keys. There was a whole rack of old keys. And I remembered that my son collected old keys, and I thought I'd pick up a few for him. And I picked up a few, and they were real interesting. And I thought, well, these are really pretty impressive. They're too good for the little bastard. I'll get some for me, too. So I started. That was my starting to collect keys. Eventually, I joined the American Collectors Association and went to a national convention with my collection at that point. I had a lot of fun with that for quite a while. That whole trip around the world was an adventure that I shall treasure always.
You know, I've known you for so long now, and I didn't know that you had traveled all around the world. I knew you had traveled to a lot of interesting places, and I'd heard about some of them in the stories that you tell, but I didn't know that you had done all around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Was that all in one trip, or was it in various trips that you took?
Was it what or what?
Did you do it all at once, or was it just...
Yeah, a trip around the world. Yeah, it took 6 weeks to go around the world.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't know that, Ben. You know, you're so amazing because you keep surprising me with things I didn't know about you. But then I guess the fact that you have been here 100 years, there's a lot of things that I wouldn't know about you. What were
100
some
years really is quite a while, isn't it?
It is a while, yeah. I mean, oh, gosh. So where were some of the places that you most enjoyed traveling to, and why?
Oh, one of the of all the travel I've done, of all the places I've been, one of the places that was the most interesting is Belize. What do you know about Belize? Anything?
No, not really. I have a friend who has been there before, but I don't know anything about it.
Well, when I grew up, that was British Honduras. I don't know when it became Belize.
Hmm.
I went there. I was on my way to tour of the Yucatan Peninsula, the Mayan culture, and one of the few canned tours I've ever taken. I took a look at the map. What can I do interesting on the way to the Yucatan? And it was going to start in Guatemala City. I looked at a map, and there's British Honduras, and what can I... Well, I can't find British Honduras. Come to find out, it's called Belize now. And the more I learned about it, the more interested I was, because there was very little I could find out.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I'd go by way of Belize. Well, there was technically a state of war between Belize and Great Britain, because of the Guatemalans claimed Belize. And when I got there, I was quite fascinated. The stories about Belize are endless. That was one of the more interesting places I met on the trip that I wouldn't have otherwise.
I always love hearing your stories about living on Oahu. And tell us just a little bit about that, because I'd love for our listeners to be able to hear a little bit about what it was like living on Oahu in,
well,
was it 1941?
Well, I didn't live there. What had happened was my father worked for the Navy, and he got a job. He was transferred to Pearl Harbor. I was attending the University of Washington at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was 20, and I thought it would be a lot of fun to go to Hawaii, and so I wasn't ready to leave the nest yet anyway, really. So I went along. We lived at Pearl Harbor. I was there at the time of the attack, and the Hawaii that was before the war really was an Eden. I think there's the rosy glow of nostalgia, it's true, but it really was a very special place. For one thing, it was remote. It doesn't seem so to us today at all. People go over for lunch practically. But then it was an island, and it was remote, and it was quiet and peaceful, and people got along, and there was a great mixture of races.
Mm-hmm.
The university wasn't much on a scholastic level, but as a view of people my own age from around the Pacific, because quite a few Asians sent their kids to Hawaii, it was to get an American education without really having had to live in America. They were still quite at home, and either Chinese or Japanese were quite at home in Hawaii then.
Mm-hmm.
And the pace was so different. And I've told you the story of how the fact, and people don't believe this, that during sometimes at the Honolulu jail, they let some of the prisoners out for the weekend. It just seems a shame to have penned up. And it isn't as ridiculous as it sounds, because it was an island. There's no way to get in. Where do you hide? It was that kind of a fundamental difference in way of living, that the spirit of Aloha was real. There's some of it left, but a tiny fraction. It permeated our lives in all respects.
Well, I'll tell you, the word aloha and what it means has just been so much, I can relate to that so much.
Well, it is. You know Hawaii enough to know that the word can't really be translated.
Mm-hmm.
It means hello and goodbye and love and things like that. But the spirit of aloha is broader than that.
Yeah.
It's a warmth.
Yeah, it's a warm, warm feeling, and I love it. I love that about it.
And give my aloha to somebody or other is a little more personal than say hello to so-and-so for me. Give my aloha to means I send a spirit of aloha.
Aloha. I just love the way it sounds. And
there was a story about...
To say it here.
Just before I visited, there'd been a congressional delegation there about something, and they had a banquet forum the night before or the day before they took ship back to the States. We didn't have the clippers then. Anyhow, they had this dinner, and everybody got drunk, of course, and one of the American politicians was giving a farewell speech thanking the locals, and being a politician, he had to work in something about local color, for make it sound sincere. So he said, and all I could say is, I sum it all up in one word, and he apparently read the word aloha more than heard it, and he was drunk, and he said, all I can say is aloho, 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 which means testicles, testicles, testicles.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He didn't know how to pronounce aloha. Oh, gosh. I had never even thought about that because, you know, the first time I had been to Hawaii was when Dudley and I went for our honeymoon in 1982 in June. And just the feeling when you get off the plane and you walk into the airport and then the island, and, you know, we started out on Oahu, then we went to Kauai for a couple of days and then went to Maui for the rest of it.
And
but
the air is like velvet, isn't it?
It is. It just, oh, my gosh. It just, oh, that's why I post so many pictures of it on Facebook and on Instagram, is that it reminds me of what it felt like to be there and how, I think part of it, too, is that you get so many people who are, excuse me, enjoying themselves in the present moment that you,
yes,
you feel more of a connection when you're there with other people. There's just,
yeah,
I don't know. Hard to explain, but it's a feeling that is just amazing, and I'm so thankful.
I think
thankful.
The living in the moment does sum up the essence of what that's about. Now, take a look at that Hawaii and remove three-quarters of the people, three-quarters of the buildings, all the newest ones,
mm-hmm,
and add a lot of automobiles and stench. Remove all those things, and that's what Hawaii was like.
You know, luckily, even with all the buildings and the cars, though, it still smells really fresh there. And, I mean, because it's totally surrounded by ocean, you know, and they get the,
yep,
breezes and everything. So unlike how California was in the, oh, my gosh, when it was, I was living down in the San Jose area in the mid-70s, it was so smoggy down there. Now it's,
yep,
better down there than it used to be, but yeah, I've never seen any smog or smelled any when I've been in
Oahu.
Oh,
I'm surprised. On trips back, I have, be that as it may. Okay.
Okay. Now,
I guess I'm too yapping about that.
Do you want to talk about your art now, or do you want to talk about your book first? Or your work with in designing the tissue boxes. Just choose a topic.
Well, your audience has to understand that a long stretch, most of my working career was with Fiberboard Corporation,
mm-hmm,
whose national headquarters was here in San Francisco. And during much of that time, I was in the Creative Design Center down the San Francisco waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a fascinating time and a fascinating job because I'm one of the few people I know that actually ended up in the job they went to college about. People go to more people than not end up working on something different than they prepared for in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I majored in economics and minored in art, and this was perfect for the design center because I was the analysis end of the design center. I was a marketing man with a background in design.
Oh.
And packaging is by its nature, it's ubiquitous. You walk into a grocery store and all those boxes on the shelves, and we made most of them. And
wow,
our design center designed some of them. The tissue box is for the benefit of your audience, this was a Toastmaster speech with this prop,
mm-hmm,
in my hand, and it was a redesign of the tissue packaging for Crown Zellerbach Corporation. And the story, to make a long and complicated story short, is Crown wanted to increase their market share. Mighty Kleenex totally dominated tissue, and they wanted to get a little bit more market share. Could we do anything about the packaging to help? And our Creative Design Center went to work on it. By the time we were through, we had designed what amounted to the first tissue box out there that, instead of being a paper product with the brand screaming at you,
mm-hmm,
as you picked up the box and every time you wanted to blow your nose, we had designed what amounted to a dispenser box. So now it's something, instead of shouting, it wanted to be very discreet and just fade into the background, but be identifiable. So, but when she blew her nose, she didn't have to have your name blaring at her from the package, mm-hmm. which is, after all, rude, and you don't want to do that. And they, now, this isn't rocket science, and this isn't any great contribution to Western civilization, but we did increase their market share through package design. And it happened to be a really neat product development story. It was a very interesting field, because what I did was I was the link between marketing objectives and the graphic designer on the board. Translate marketing objectives into package design is what it boiled down to. So it was a very interesting career. Didn't make any money, but I got a good salary, but I didn't, you know. I didn't make money like I would have in real estate, perhaps, or something else, but I had a hell of a lot of fun, learned a lot. I worked with excellent people, and that's a very good part of any career, to work with excellent people.
Oh, so true, so true. It makes such a difference to work with people that you enjoy and you can collaborate with, and it sounds like collaboration was a huge part of that job.
And this is a place where you're talking about communication. This is a point where, needless to say, communication is key. If you're working with people on development projects, you've got to have excellent communication.
That's really true. So was that when you first joined Toastmasters, way back then?
Yeah.
In fact,
at one point we had a company... company Toastmaster group. I suppose they still exist.
They do,
and
some of the big companies have them in their company, and so they usually meet more like at lunchtime, something like that.
Yeah, and this is interesting because how do you evaluate your boss's lousy speech? Yeah, there's some swampy areas out there you have to be aware of.
Well, that's
for
one
that
of the
reason,
reasons.
I'm not sure it's too good an idea.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, for me, I've always thought of Toastmasters as being for personal development, not just professional development. And I think that, for me, that's part of why I've stayed in it all these years, because I've been in it, as you know, over 15 years, and it's my favorite place to be on Wednesday night because I'm always curious what people are going to talk about. It's not like they're going to talk about a presentation for the company. You know, that we get people in all kinds of different careers and interests, and we get authors and artists and, you know, musicians and all kinds of different people that are fun. And
there are people
creativity.
You would not have met otherwise.
Exactly. And we have, I mean, you're our oldest member, obviously, at being 100 years young now. And then we have Amanda, I think, is our youngest one. She's like in her early 20s. I think she just finished college or something like that. So, you know, and then we have people all ages in between, too. But it's a place where you can meet people. That's what I love about it. I can meet people who are positive and they want to learn more about communication and leadership, and they also enjoy talking and listening and communicating with each other. So, yeah, it's a great place to be. Now, we only have 23 minutes left, and I just want to make sure that we have time to talk about your book and your art. So which one do you want to talk about next?
Let's talk about the book.
Okay. Tell us about your book.
The word, Field Guide to the F Word.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to describe because it isn't typical of books that are out there. There are several books on the F word. One of them, that's the sole title, But they tend to have been done a few years ago when there was still some shock value left, like there isn't anymore, really.
Mm-hmm.
And that just probably gets out of hand because it is so frequent now in movies, particularly in TV. It is so mm-hmm. common that there isn't really much of usable like society, but there's certainly no real shock value left. I'm a word freak anyway. I've always been interested in words, and I started mm-hmm. looking up history of the word. I don't know what came to mind, but I tried to run it down.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out for a word that is this common, the more I learned about the word, the more interested I became. true.
Well, you helped diffuse the feelings I had about it, which was something I was really thankful for, because you came into my life during a time when I was horrified by the fact that so many people were using the word, including our son and my husband, and too frequently, in my opinion. So, you know, I love that the book is done with a sense of humor, and I love what it says in the beginning, how in order to save ink, I think it was, that the word doesn't even appear in the book, which is true.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't. do you know that for a word this common, no, it really is not clearly established what its origin is. There are a couple of dozen theories floating around. Most of them are ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But even the OED, than which there is no whisher, look it up sometime if you have an opportunity. There are a lot of proposals, most of which don't hold water.
Mm-hmm.
But it is really not definitely established, and that's amazing in itself. But
mm-hmm.
A couple of things about the book. For one thing, this is not a book so much to be read as to have. It's a smaller than it is. It's a coffee table book. It's meant to mm-hmm. engender discussion. It's a conversation starter. But take a look at a couple of facts about it that I found fascinating. One of the serious points made in the book
mm-hmm.
is the in addition to its complete versatility and the fact that the root of the word is really not clearly established.
Mm-hmm.
One of the findings of the book is how remarkable it is that, just take a look at the word snafu, which is in the American language and has been mm-hmm. for some years. One of the serious contentions made in the book, because the book is a bit of a serious study of some aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
The word existed. The first time there's any record of it in print was in, I think it was 1489. But in the year, say, 1500,
mm-hmm.
the word was extant. It was around, highly taboo, never in print, never or rarely in print, and referred to a specific physical act.
Mm-hmm.
It was that way until 1900, 400 years, without any change at all. In 1930s, when I first heard the word as a child, it was extant, highly taboo, rarely in print, and referring to a specific physical act. Now, at that point, the word was much more around because now it had become the iconic graffito on latrine walls, but nonetheless, the word did not change at all in 400 years. Then came World War II, and by the end of the war, snafu was a word in the American language. And that's one of my contentions, that the word as we know it really is a product of the American English-speaking serviceman in World War II. There were parallel. It was also used in Canada, Australia, and England.
Now I didn't
the
know.
Other,
I didn't.
Point,
oh, okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
The other serious contention I make in the book is that I discovered and wrote the book because of there are rules. There really are. Nobody's written them down, as far as I can tell. But so I kind of did. I looked at the way it is used and the way it isn't used and tried to have a little fun with the word.
Mm-hmm.
So you were going to make, no doubt you were going to comment on the snafu.
Snafu, yeah, because I hadn't known what that was until the last time I had you on the show.
I didn't know that anybody didn't know what snafu
is. Well, tell our listeners so that they can know if they don't know. You know.
Situation normal, all fouled up approximately.
Mm-hmm.
All fouled up. That's good enough
for
anything.
Yeah, fouled up. There you go.
With endless variations, like the many of the developments during World War II, I think, have gradually been dropped or forgotten. Skimfu, situation changed, even more fouled up. And my favorite is Poobar.
What's
which
that?
Which is fouled up beyond all recognition.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh, Ben. That's funny. Well, you know, I have to say that we have the book. Actually, we have several copies. I think our son, we gave one to our son. My husband has one. I've got one. We've got signed copies because we got them from you. And I love the illustrations in it, too. There's all these really cool illustrations and stories. And I don't know, you know, it just, even though it taught me to be able to understand it, and like you said, realize that there are rules, and that's part of the problem lately is that people just use it all the time, and so it's lost its impact.
Yeah,
but I don't know how
like,
we can get them to stop doing it to have it have more impact anyway. So, yeah.
Like people, it comes out wrong when. For example, in fixation, when the word is inserted into another one, is it more fun in the book where there's a blank where there ought to be the word rather than substituting vowel? But things like where you put the emphasis if the word is infix, like you might hear somebody say, I have to say, fouled, don't I? Or how do I foul? Yeah, fouled.
Okay.
You could say, you might hear somebody say, unfouling believable.
Or unfrigging believable.
It's not wrong. It's
unfrigging
believable. The emphasis is, the word is precedes the emphasized syllable.
Uh-huh.
Now, that rule does exist to infixed words, all kinds of infixed words, but it definitely applies to snafu and where the infix. This is the kind of thing I mean that nobody seems to have analyzed the word in this way, looking at various, playing with it. Okay, I've yapped enough about the book.
All right, now I want you to talk to us about your art, your wall sculptures, which are incredible.
Okay.
And I've got some pictures of the art in the slideshow that people can see while they're listening. So tell us about how you got started doing that, why, and how you created
it. I don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't really know exactly how I got started, but I've ended up with this art form. I'd never seen anybody do it. And that was essentially, I'm fascinated with light and the way light, when a shape is subjected to angled light, the play of shadow and highlight and the gradual shading around a curve and sharply at a corner.
Mm-hmm.
And so these wall sculptures could be looked at as painting with shadow and light instead of pigment and canvas, really. It was all wood. The wood was directly out of the lumberyard, pretty much, building the frames and the shapes. And I had a guy, I don't use power equipment, I had a guy with his portable skill saw up here at the house, and I give him the work order. I want yea many cylinders or blocks or whatever of these dimensions. And he'd rip them out, and I'd arrange them, and together we would glue them into place, and then they were painted white. Things were almost entirely white, a little bit of color added.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what it boils down to, is shadow and highlight. And they were wall size, anywhere from two by 3 feet to a bit smaller, and two to 3 feet, some mm-hmm. a little smaller, some a bit larger. And I had a couple of shows, and they were well received, and it's difficult to compare them with, because they're not like anything else. I don't know.
You know, they aren't like anything else I'd ever seen, and still haven't. And I just absolutely love your art. And that's one of the things I love about going over to your house to visit you. And I feel so blessed that Dudley and Xander and I have all been able to go over and spend time with you in your lovely home, and with all the views of Mill Valley and your yin and yang bathrooms. It's just, you know, it's a wonderful place to visit, and I can see why it's probably helped keep you happy. But you've got the art all over in there, and during the shows, you sold some of the art, and we have one of them. I'm so thankful we have it, Ben, hanging in our living room. And I remember Dorothy from our Toastmasters Club coming over and saying, "You have an original Ben." And I am so thankful that we do.
Well, I'm glad you do, too.
Yeah, it's one of our treasures for sure, and you're one of our treasured friends, and it's just been so much fun having you in our lives and club, and I just, I'm so thankful for knowing you and for having you in my life. And I'm thinking, though, looking back over your life, what are some of the choices and decisions that you're really super glad you made?
Well, one of the decisions I'm most glad I made was buying this house. When I bought it, it wasn't old, but it had been badly treated, and it was sort of falling apart here and there. Locks didn't work. There were holes in the walls. But it had, it appealed to me immediately because of the location. It was at the end of a small private mountain road. There were only 10 houses on the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the uppermost house, and so there were trees, this being Mill Valley. It was a wooded hillside, mostly oak trees.
Mm-hmm.
There were oak trees on three sides and a valley view on the fourth. Being the last house, there was no through traffic. Well, two of the things toughest to come by in this world are privacy and quiet, and here they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I remodeled the house almost completely top to bottom, and it is now pretty much just what I want. One of the smartest decisions was having bought the house. But there have been career decisions. When I decided to go to work for Fiberboard and ended up in the design center.
Mm-hmm.
The I looking, you automatically at a marker like 100th birthday, there is a tendency automatically to kind of look back and review, and I don't really have any regrets except one, which is a big one. I was a lousy husband a lot of years ago.
Mm.
But by and large, I haven't gotten any regrets. And who knows how life anybody's life would be if they'd made different decisions at various points. But, hell, you play as you see it, and there's no point in looking back, right?
Well, you know, there is a point if it's, you know, if you can learn from it. That's the thing. You know, there's
oh, yes.
the past, there's the present, and there's the future. And by looking back at the past and thinking of choices and decisions that you regret, you can learn from them and hopefully make different decisions in the future. And also by talking about the choices that you've made in the past that you were glad you made and also the ones you regret making, it's a way for other people to learn too, because we all learn from each other and we're all either role models or warnings. That's what I like to say. You know, and we all can be role models and warnings in various ways. I mean, none of us, we're all human, so none of us are totally perfect, and none of us can honestly say that we've never made a mistake. Mistakes are just part of living. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and how you define a mistake while you're at it. And not forgetting that for every choice we made, there were a whole bunch of choices we didn't, and we don't know what any of those would have led to. So there you go. What are you going to compare it with? The hell with it. It's past.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the thing. You have to just keep moving forward. And I think one of the things that you have mastered is being in the present moment and being really present with people. And I think that, for me anyway, and I know for Dudley and Xander, that's one of the things that we really enjoy about being with you, is when we're with you, you're just there. You're just present. And it just feels so good to be with somebody who is so present in life. And also, you have a lot of gratitude and appreciation for what you have and what you're able to do. And it reminds me, knowing you reminds me to be present. And to listen, and to take in the beauty around me, and to enjoy the creativity that we have in this world, and to be curious, to keep being curious, never to think I know it all, never to stop learning, to be a lifelong learner. Those are some of the lessons I've learned from knowing you and having you in our lives.
You're too kind.
Oh, you know what? I hear that a lot. But I don't know if I've ever told you this story, but the reason that I am like that is because in my 20s, I had a teacher, college years, who said that life gives out plenty of cold pricklies all the time. So she said, go around giving as many warm fuzzies as you can. So I do.
Well, very good.
Yep, I like
Jesus
to give
wants
out.
Me for a sunbeam.
What was that?
Jesus wants me for a sunbeam. Did you ever go to Sunday school?
You know, when I was super little, and then we moved to the country, so we didn't go to Sunday school anymore, but my mom used to read us stories, Bible stories from children's Bible storybooks about Jesus. What did you
there was
really?
A hymn that we used to sing, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam. It's not a bad principle to follow.
I like it, though, you know, because that's one of my intentions in life is to be like warm golden sun in the lives of all who know me. Yeah.
As long as we're taking a look at what I've learned and stuff, one that I won't dwell on, but I am privately quite a religious man. I don't belong to any church, but I was brought up with Sunday school and quit as soon as I was able to get away with quitting.
Me
but,
too.
when I was in my think I was in my late 40s, I had a religious experience which changed my life. And that's all I have to say on that subject. It did change my life for the better, and I wasn't seeking this at all, and there it was one day.
Well, that's what happens when you're paying attention, you know, when you're living your life and paying attention. Do you realize we only have 2 minutes left? So it's a good thing that you're not going to tell the whole story because we don't have time. But one of these days I want to hear the story.
My sister I had, who was the fellow word freak, she came up with wonderful sayings, too. And one of them was, I don't know where she got it, but it's kind of nice. Life, the definition of life, there are a lot of them out there. Life is what happens to you while you're making plans.
Yeah, that's so true. So true. So many people are planning and planning and planning and planning and not ever living in their present moment.
Right.
And the present, yeah, the present moment is where joy lives. Excuse me. Oh, Ben, thank you for being on my show again, and thank you so much for being in our Toastmasters Club still, and for your art, and one of these days I want to get another piece of your art, and definitely want more Ben art in our house.
I have enjoyed. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, we've got 90 seconds left. So what's one short thing you want to leave the audience with?
I guess I can't say it better than be here now.
I love that. Be here now. Woohoo!
Yeah.
Yeah, Ram Dass. I remember him saying that. And it's so true. Be here now. Well, thank you again for being on my show and being in our lives.
My pleasure.
Aloha.
Aloha, no, hello.
Aloha, Ben. Happy 100th birthday, our treasured friend. We love you.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye for now, everyone. Get out there and live your music. Whatever music you hear calling you, live it. Do it now. Bye, Ben.
Bye,
everybody. Aloha.